Welcome into David L. Gray in the morning. After the saints of the day, we're going to get into today's top story. U.S. military commanders are telling their troops that God has called them to engage in a holy war against Iran. They're calling it a holy crusade. I'm being serious. And Pope Leo has a lot to say, as you know, about war and immigration, but when he was asked about Christian persecution in China, he said, no comment. That's strange. So we'll talk about that. And then after all that, I'm going to inspire you with a commentary on today's readings at Mass. I'm going to give you the three ways to overcome feeling misunderstood, misrepresented, feeling that you're surrounded by quiet opposition, or that you're feeling all alone in doing what is right. How does it feel to be the prophet Jeremiah? We'll talk about that. And that's today's show. Thanks for coming in. And I hope that I bring you lots of joy and lots of peace today. Let's go ahead and get into the saint of the day, which is brought to you by St. Dominic's Media, your trusted source for Catholic liturgy and history. You know, if you're serious about living a liturgical life, St. Dominic's Media, we built an entire ecosystem to help you with free retreats, free courses, free ebooks, free podcasts, all designed to help you become in a world who you've been called to be and been formed to be through the Catholic Mass. And here's the best part, that it's almost unbelievable that for just a one-time lifetime membership of $360, you become what St. Dominic's Media calls a hound of heaven, a lifetime member, a hound of heaven. And St. Dominic's Media, when you become a hound of heaven, we'll send you one copy of every book we've ever published. And you'll receive that in your mail, and you'll receive a copy of every book that we will publish in the future. No renewals, no hidden fees, just a lifetime of formation in your mailbox. So you get every book published, including books such as some popular ones, the Catholic Catechism on Freemasonry, the definitive book on what the Catholic Church teaches about Freemasonry, and the liturgical sense of the readings of the Mass. You get year A now, and then year B and C in the future. So, and all of our books. So you get 10 books immediately, every book we publish this year, and you'll get three that we're going to publish this year and next year, and so on and so forth. So it's a great deal. Like I said, a lifetime of formation delivered to your door. So visit stdominicsmedia.com and join the mission. It's one of the best deals in Catholic publishing. So let's get into the saints of the day, who is St. Casimir. And St. Casimir's, his life really just shines with a quiet, steady holiness that feels almost surprising for a young prince that was raised in the splendor of the royal court. So St. Casimir was born in 1458 to King Casimir IV of Poland and Queen Elizabeth of Austria. He grew up surrounded by power, privilege, and political expectation, but from an early age, his heart bent toward God with a purity and intensity that set him apart. And he referred prayer to luxury and service to status and integrity to ambition. And Casimir became known for his deep devotion to Christ and to the Blessed Virgin Mary. He lived austerely, even in the palace, choosing simplicity, fasting, and generosity to the poor. His compassion was not theoretical. He personally visited the sick, defended the oppressed, and gave freely from his own resources. Those who knew him described him as gentle, joyful, and unwaveringly just. Though pressured into political and military roles, Casimir refused to support unjust warfare, choosing conscience over convenience. And his fidelity cost him influence, but it preserved his soul. He died at a young age. He was only 26, but his short life left a legacy of purity, courage, and charity that continues to inspire. And St. Casimir is honored as the patron saint of Poland and Lithuania, and as the patron of youth, purity, and no-seeking integrity of heart. His life reminds us that holiness is possible anywhere, even in the halls of power, when a heart is anchored in God. St. Casimir, gentle prince and faithful servant of Christ, pray for us. I'll be right back with your top stories. This is David L. Gray in the morning. Hey there, I'm David L. Gray. I'm a Catholic theologian doing my doctoral studies at the Catholic University of America in liturgical catechesis. Welcome to my morning show. We live stream every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with your Saint of the Day, top news stories, and a commentary on the readings at Mass. If you like what you hear, please hit that like, share, and sub, and leave a comment so that more people can find this program. Thank you, and God bless. Hey, welcome back in to David L. Gray in the morning. Let's go ahead and get into today's top stories. This is, both of these stories are really going to maybe shock you if you haven't heard about them already. Shocking, a little disappointing, but you know, we were made in joy because of who we belong to. But concerning what's going on in Iran, what if this isn't just another geopolitical standoff? What if we're watching, unfolds feels less like foreign policy and more like theology in uniform? You know, there are moments in history when the air feels charged, when something beneath the surface hums with the kind of spiritual tension that catches us off guard. And lately, many people have begun to wonder whether we're living through one of those moments, not because of some sort of secret holy war, but because of the uneasy way religion, nationalism, and military power sometimes begin to blur the edges. You know, they've told us that this is about nuclear centrifuges, about stopping a regime that chants death to America, about liberating the Iranian people from the tyranny of the Ayatollahs. That is the official story, the one they feed the press, the one that fits neatly into the 30-minute segment news cycles. But in the barracks, in the briefing rooms, in the closed doors, a different gospel is being preached. It is a gospel that should terrify every American who still believes in the separation of church and state. The Military Religious Freedom Foundation is being inundated with hundreds of complaints from all across the country, from 40 different units so far, across insulation all around, like I said, the world. The commanders of our military, the very people who have been sworn to uphold the Constitution, are telling their troops that this war is not about politics or national security. It's about prophecy. They're using this phrase that this war has been, and the soldiers have been anointed by Jesus. This is what's been in the reports from the Religious Freedom Foundation, that commanders are telling their soldiers that they have been anointed by Jesus. They're saying to light the signal fire in Iran, to cause Armageddon, to mark the return of Christ. Let that sink in. This is not some fringe group of soldiers praying in the foxhole. No, this is the chain of command. Non-commissioned officers are being told to pass this message down, that the blood that is about to be shed, American and Iranian, is part of God's divine plan, is what they're saying. This is ripped straight from the book of Revelation, or at least the Protestant interpretation of it. One complainant in the Religious Freedom Foundation has said that, who's a Christian himself, speaking for about 15 troops, including a Muslim and a Jew, who now sees their commander is telling them that they are merely extras in this holy war. Now, for people, for years, you know, people have been warning about the alliance between the MAGA movement and the Protestant Christian Zionist. You know, we were told not to worry, that it was just political pandering. It was just a voting block. We were naive. The weaponization of the military for an apocalyptic fundamentalist agenda is not a conspiracy theory. It's happening right now in real time. The Pentagon, led by a zealot Protestant, has even yet to acknowledge these reports. Now, some of you might be thinking, but what if Iran's regime is truly evil? What if they do persecute Christians, which they do, and they imprison their own people? That's true. You're right. The Iranian people do deserve freedom from a brutal theocracy. If this war were truly and purely about liberation and human rights of the Iranians, you know, there might be some sort of more argument to be made. Some might find a shred of consolation in the idea that this terrible conflict could bring about a common good. But that's not the ideology driving this bus. This is about Zionist ideology, not the simple support for Israel's right to exist, but the specific radical Protestant Zionist belief that the gathering of Jews in the Holy Land and the conflagration of war in the Middle East are necessary precursors to the end times and the second coming. This is a theology that views the state of Israel, and by extension, its conflict, its sin, not as a nation to be protected for its own sake, but as a chess piece in a cosmic, bloody finale. It is a long game that requires the world to burn. It requires the bloody battle between Mikey Weinstein's clients, the things that they're hearing about, such euphoria they're hearing about from their commanders. And this is the part that everyone should fear, because this is not a war you can win. It is a war you can only end, and the people commanding our troops seem to have no intention of ending it anytime soon. They're just waiting on a finale that they're intentionally designing, the script that they're writing and directing all by themselves. It's not on us, the United States military, to bring about the end of the world. It's not our job to fulfill some sort of interpretation of some ancient prophecy. That's not policy. That's not patriotism. That is man playing God with the lives of our sons and our daughters and setting the entire Middle East ablaze to satisfy a feverish dream from the Book of Revelations. And I think, you know, if you're concerned about this, I think you're right to be concerned about the U.S. doing the bidding of a foreign government in a weird ideology and a weird interpretation of the Bible. You should be concerned about the United States doing that bidding. But we should be terrified that we are now doing also the bidding of this interpretation, this Protestant interpretation of the Bible, and directing the commanders of our military to evangelize it to our troops in a heat of battle. That's not freedom of religion. That's the establishment of one specific radical faith and wrong faith as the unofficial policy of the United States military. And that is a war that the world is not ready to endure. This is David L. Gray in the morning. And, you know, there's another side of the coin of this, of weird things this week. Things they say you really didn't expect to see on your bingo card this week. You know, the Vatican seems to be engaging in a conspiracy of silence. No, weird conspiracy of silence. Now, we seem to have a Vatican that is quick, very quick to speak on politics and immigration policy and climate change, but not speak for those being persecuted. You know, there are moments when the church's voice should be a thunderclap, and moments when its silence should be a tombstone. But lately, for too many Catholics, it feels like we're being buried alive between those two extremes. You know, when violence in the Middle East erupted, the Holy See and Pope Leo XIV responded swiftly, condemning the attack on Iran with an unmistakable urgency. But that same urgency was nowhere to be found when Iran was killing thousands of its own citizens, imprisoning tens of thousands of its own citizens, and crushing religious minorities, including Christians. You know, the contrast was very jarring. When Iran and the United States attacked Iran to fulfill this Protestant biblical prophecy, you know, Pope Leo was quick to say, you know, everyone needs to calm down. Dialogue. Heard me say that? But at the beginning of the year and the end of last year, when Iran was just brutalizing its own citizens, Pope had nothing to say. Nothing to say. Happy New Year. Bless the Solemnity, the Blessed Mother Mary. Fine. But people were just hoping that we would have a Pope that would be consistent. Say something or say nothing at all, but either way, be consistent. And the contrast is just jarring. And raised many questions that Catholics have been whispering for years. This is the same sort of thing we've been getting for years at the Vatican. We changed the Pope, but it's still the same behavior. Why does the Vatican speak loudly in some moments and fall silent in others? Why is that? And that question sharpened again when journalists asked Pope Leo XIV about Jimmy Lai, the imprisoned Hong Kong Catholic publisher and pro-democracy advocate. Lai is not an abstract symbol. He is a baptized Catholic, a man who has openly tied his conscience to his faith, and who is now serving a long sentence under China's national security law. His case has become a global emblem of the struggle for freedom in speech in China. And yet, when asked specifically about him, the Pope said nothing. Now, who is Jimmy Lai, if you never heard of him, and why does his case matter? Well, he was born in mainland China. He fled to Hong Kong as a child and built a very successful clothing empire. And he founded Apple Daily, one of Hong Kong's most influential pro-democracy newspapers. And he converted to Catholicism as an adult and was guided in that conversion process by Cardinal Zinn. And he was inspired by what the church teaches on human dignity and freedom. And he was arrested multiple times for participating in peaceful protests. Then he was charged under China's national security law, widely criticized by human rights groups. And when this happened, and he's been in prison since 2020 with additional trials still ongoing. So again, like I said, he's recognized internationally as a prisoner of conscience. So for many Catholics, Lai represents really the cost of discipleship in a world where authoritarian regimes fear truth tellers. And so this is why the Vatican's silence right now feels so heavy when a Pope is asked specifically about him. You know, we're quick to hear from the Pope about climate change, blessing ICE, you know. But, you know, the Vatican, but when it comes to this, you know, why the eerie silence? Why does Pope Leo say he can't comment? Why can't he comment? He's Pope. And this is a Catholic. So the Vatican's approach to China has been, you know, controversial for years, to say the least. we look at the provisional agreement on the appointment of bishops that was negotiated under Pope Francis, which was intended to unify the underground church and the state-recognized Catholic Church. But critics argue that it has instead emboldened Beijing and weakened the underground church and compromised the church's moral authority. That's a fair criticism. And there have been persistent questions surrounding this about China's influence on Vatican diplomacy. So when the Pope is asked about Jimmy Lai, and he says, "I can't comment." Okay, well, now we're back to our suspicions being affirmed. How much influence does China have over the Vatican? How much money are they receiving? Is that hush money? What's going on? And so the opacity of the agreements, what's really in there? We still haven't seen the details. The Vatican has been very reluctant to tell us exactly what's going on between them and China. And they've been consistently, again, the Pope is very loud about climate change and immigration policy. He's very boisterous about what he doesn't like about the United States. But when it comes to criticizing Beijing's human rights abuses, he doesn't say anything. So some Catholics point to the involvement of figures like Cardinal McCarrick, who reportedly played a role in the early diplomatic outreach to China. Others note that the deal's details, again, remain secret, and it fuels this suspicion and mistrust. So when a Pope condemns one geopolitical event with speed, with clarity, but remains silent about Iran's internal repression, China's treatment of Catholics, the imprisonment of Jimmy Lai, it creates the impression of selective moral outrage. And anytime your morals are compromised by just the things you say yourself, this is a concern. But when it happens from the Pope, we're like, what's that? This is why people who talk a lot, they always end up either saying too much or too little. Right? So it's better, you know, my position about the Pope, I'm not one of those people who always needs the Pope to speak on everything. You know, I actually prefer popes who are quiet, who lead by their actions, who lead through the sacraments. But if you're going to be a loquacious Pope, you're just going to talk about everything and anything, then you got to keep the same energy across the board. It's the only way. Either you're going to talk about everything or you're going to talk about nothing, but you have to choose. Because this selective outrage is worse than silence. It feels like betrayal of the church's prophetic vocation. And I think that's a real issue. Speaking too much about small things and too little about crucial ones. And the leader's credibility is not built on what they say about the easy targets. Well, anybody can comment on a football game. That's easy. You know, the Pope wants to talk about the Chicago Cubs and Chicago's pizza. Fine. That's easy. Let's talk about it. But no, that's not how leaders are formed. Leaders are forged in what they dare to say about the powerful. They're forged by what they say about things that are very inconvenient to talk about. So when the church thunders against the strike on Iran, but whispers, no comment, or stays mute about the Chinese Communist Party's systematic erasure of his faithful, of our faithful, the church's faithful, it reveals itself, doesn't it? It looks not like a prophetic voice, but a political actor, small, calculating, and morally bankrupt. And that's always sad to see when it comes to the leaders of our church, especially when it's the vicar of Christ, the successor of Peter. And the world notices this. It damages conversion. It damages faith and hope that people have in a church. And the people who persecute the church, they also notice. But most of all, the prisoners notice. Jimmy Lai rotting in a cell for his faith and his conscience notices that his spiritual father in Rome has nothing to say about him. No comment. Really? So the church does not, I would say the church doesn't need to be reckless, but it does need to be clear and courageous and consistent. We can't sit up here and say, oh, a virtue of a saint, that people will be canonized saints, is heroic virtue. Oh, this person had heroic virtue. They should have a cause of canonization. But we don't see that same heroic virtue in our leaders. Like, we should be like those whom we canonize. Because when the stakes are this high, when a man's life and the soul of the church in Asia hangs in the balance, silence is not real diplomacy. Silence is betrayal. And betrayal is wrapped in the secret deal. A deal that is really looking to be just a deal with the devil. This has been David L. Gray. Let me get to your comments and we'll get to today's readings at Mass. MJ says, morning, David. I agree to some extent, but looking at the way power works, is either you take it or lose it. The problem is the enemy never sleeps. Either China becomes a default power. I don't disagree with your comment at all. There's a tightrope to be walked on. Laura calls, I guess, the Department of War the Third Temple. Is that what you're saying? MJ says, also, we all know that nobody is comfortable with non-Christian power being the default. In that case, we all know we'll all be persecuted very fast. Yeah. Yep, that is the world we're living in, friends. Hey, this is David L. Gray. Good morning. I'll be right back with your commentary on today's readings at Mass. Hey, before we get into the readings at Mass for today, I'd like to share with you my book, The Liturgical Sense of the Readings at Mass. This is for year A, B, and C. And what I do in this book is for every Sunday and Holy Day of Obligation, I give the theology of each of the readings and how they interconnect as well. But the most unique thing about this book is that I lead you, inspire you, and teach you about how to live the liturgical life. How do you live the Mass in the world? That which you just experienced, that which you just received, that which you just heard. How do you live that in the world? So that's the purpose of the book. Check it out. You can find it anywhere online. But if you go to saintdominicsmedia.com, make sure you use the code ILOVETHEMASS. I love the Mass. And you'll get 30% off. Again, this is the liturgical sense of the readings of Mass by me, David L. Gray. God bless. Let's get back into your commentary. Hey, welcome back in to David L. Gray in the morning. I appreciate you guys coming in, those who are watching live. You know, we've been tweaking and playing with the live stream in the morning, the daily show. And we've been tweaking format and times and everything like that. And so it looked like 9 o'clock Eastern time may be a better time for the live stream, because that way we can get people in from the West Coast. We wouldn't be streaming in the middle of the night in the West Coast. So we're playing that time. So let me know if you like it. Looks like from the numbers in the live streams, what I see right now and all the different platforms that we stream this on, the numbers look triple than what they are at the, you know, the 6:45 show. So I'm excited about that. So let me know if you like this time slot, 9 o'clock Eastern time, and we'll keep doing that. But let's get into today's readings at Mass. So the Old Testament readings from Jeremiah 18 and the responsorial psalm is Psalm 31, and it is, "Save me, O Lord, in your kindness." And the gospel reading is from Matthew chapter 20, verses 17 through 28, where, Jesus, he prophesies his death. And then the mother of the sons of Zebedee approached Jesus with her sons, you know, asking, you know, she goes into her whole soccer mom mode and say, hey, can my son start? they've been sitting here on the bench, you know, can they start? Basically, you know, she went into her whole soccer mom thing. And, you know, so and Jesus responds to that. But I want to get into today's commentary is really going to be on the first reading from Jeremiah. And it says, the people of Judah and the citizens of Jerusalem said, come, let us contrive a plot against Jeremiah. It will not mean the loss of instruction from the priests, nor counsel from the wise, nor messages from the prophets. And so let us destroy him by his own tongue, and let us carefully note his every word. Heed me, O Lord, listen to what my adversaries say. Must good be repaid with evil, that they should dig a pit to take my life? Remember, I stood before you to speak in their behalf, to turn away your wrath from them. So, you know, Jeremiah is, you know, aside from Jesus, Mary, Joseph, is without question my favorite person in the scriptures. You know, I identify with him and his ministry so much. Always have. Ever since I became a Christian, you know, reading Jeremiah for me is like, I don't know, reading my journal. You know, him and I have the same complaints, you know, so it's very interesting. So I love Jeremiah. And I think many of our everyday situations echoes Jeremiah's experience. And so, you know, for example, if we take today's readings and we look at Jeremiah's complaints and we look at the people plotting against him and his response to that, how his words were twisted, ignored, and mocked. Many people today, I think, really feel this in our own just daily situations. Like when your intentions are questioned at work, and like you have good intentions, the people at work just want to question them. Or, you know, you have good intentions in your family life, and, you know, people want to question, you know, the good that you want to do. Or when you try to do the right thing, right, and then you get labeled as, oh, you're being difficult, right? That's Jeremiah. Or when you speak honestly, and then when you speak honestly, people want to assume the worst of you. Right? You ever had that experience at work or in your family? You're just being honest, and automatically people want to, you know, attack you for doing it. Or when you're, you know, you feel surrounded by like quiet opposition, like Jeremiah was. When Jeremiah heard people say, they're whispering, let us denounce him. Like people, I think people feel this in just their everyday lives. Like when they sense like coworkers talking behind their back, that's kind of common. That's something that, you know, I would hear often when I was in a workspace, right? Or, you know, people, I don't know. I was always one of those people at work that people come talk to. I don't know what it is about me. Or people, you know, people find out at work, oh, you know, Dave was getting his, you know, his doctorate degree, or when I was getting my master's degree in theology, people always assume I'm some sort of pastor. You know, I'm always quick to tell them, look, I'm nobody's pastor. That is not me. But, you know, they would always just come tell me their problems and things like that. And that's one thing I'd always hear from people, like just the infighting at work, right? Or, you know, you get like a friend group. You have a friend group. You know, I think kids experience this a lot, you know, in high school and middle school, like their friend group becomes cold and distant. That's what Jeremiah's experiencing as well. Or they feel excluded from decisions or from conversations. Like, you ever have that feeling? That's Jeremiah. Or Jeremiah, he also felt alone a lot. And that's one of his like main struggles. Like, he just felt alone in his ministry. And that's difficult for anybody, right? Especially when you feel alone in doing what is right. You ever been in that situation? That's Jeremiah. You know, that's his whole ministry, just feeling entirely alone and being faithful. Like, everyone around him is just devils, but he's faithful. You ever feel like that? And or like, you know, like you're the only one in your family or in your friend group, like trying to practice the faith, like you're married to someone who just not interested in living a good life, a virtuous life, or your kids have turned away from the faith. Like you're the only person in your family that's praying for people. Everyone else is either lukewarm or they've set on another path against from God. That's Jeremiah. Or you ever feel like you're the only one at work resisting unethical shortcuts? Right. I've been there too. When I was a finance manager in an auto dealership, like the lady next to me, she's also a finance manager. She made a lot of money. She did like double what I was making as a finance manager, selling all types of insurance policies and this and that. But she was like completely unethical. This lady used to sell, these people come in, buy a Cadillac, and they're like, they're in dotage. They're about to die the next day. You can tell they're just old, but they want a Cadillac, right? That's, you know, that's what old people like to drive. And these people are so old, and she's selling them this 10-year warranty for their car. You know, I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't sell people things that I knew they didn't need. Or sometimes we'd be selling a Cadillac. It's a used Cadillac. And it has issues. And so the owner, one of the assistant owner, co-owners of the dealership, they would come to me and say, hey, David, make sure you sell the warranty plan on that car right there because they're going to need it. And I'm like, and I'll push the warranty, of course, and they'll buy it. But I'm like, well, first of all, why are we selling this car? Why? Or like, you know, when I push up the financing, right? And I get financing back. And of course, I can make a lot more money by going with this bank versus that bank. But, you know, I'm looking at these people. I see their finances. I see they're struggling. So it was my job, no matter what, to make the most money. So I'm supposed to push the financing that's like a 7% interest rate, knowing, you know, I can go to a credit union and get like a 3.2, right? So I would do the 3.2, right? I didn't last long at Cadillac. They sent me down to Chevy. They sent me to the Chevy dealership. So they downgraded me. But yeah, because, you know, it's hard. You work in these environments where you have these unethical shortcuts. Or you ever been in a situation where you're the only one in a group who won't join in on the gossip or the negativity? Or you're feeling overwhelmed by like responsibility like Jeremiah was, right? When you're carrying people's burdens, the burdens of your family that no one sees, or you feel responsible for some sort of ministry or project or team that depends on you. And it can feel overwhelming, or you feel like stretched thin by like the expectations people have that all of you that you didn't ask for. And so sometimes people have expectations for you and you don't know why they have them for you. And that can feel a lot, or you can feel emotionally exhausted or spiritually dry at times. Like Jeremiah said, why is my pain unceasing? Right, why is my pain unceasing? That's what he said. And so, yeah, people do feel tired of being a strong person. You can feel tired for being strong for others. Or you can feel like you're the one always praying, but you're not feeling anything. You can have that dry season, right? That's feeling like Jeremiah as well. And so you can feel sometimes like you're doing the good, but you're not getting the results. And so, yeah, those are like real circumstances. So Jeremiah, we look at Jeremiah, like, we could say, well, Jeremiah survives all of these things. Now, first, by telling God the truth about his fear. So I'm going to give you the three steps to overcome all these things that you might be feeling in your life. And the three steps to turn these fears that you may have, like Jeremiah have, like turn your fears into mission. And I'm going to relate those into also to how the liturgy reinforces that teaching and is teaching us in like in a pedagogical way through repetition. Every time you go to Mass, we should turn fear into mission. And that relates to today. Like, there's a lot of things, a lot of disappointment that we can look into the world and say, man, this is crazy. It's a lot of things of fear. Yeah. But, you know, what the liturgy comes and do, it wants to give us hope in this way as well. So it's going to turn. So here are the three steps that turn fear into mission. And I call it also Jeremiah's path in a liturgy. So if you're in a Mass, and so there's three times in a Mass where you can relate this to Jeremiah's life. And that's why I call it his path in liturgy. So the first thing that Jeremiah does, and we see, is that he confesses what's going on in his life. Like in everything, whenever everything is like crap and the whole world is turning on him, like the first thing that Jeremiah does is talk to God. He confesses like all his pain, all his suffering. And it looks like in the book of Jeremiah, he's always complaining and he's always whining. He's always like throwing these pity parties. But no, he's really just, he's confessing just like we do in a penitential rite, telling God exactly what's going on in our life. And this is how Jeremiah survives, by telling God the truth about his fears, about his wounds, and even his anger. You notice that? In the same way, in a penitential rite, in the liturgy's way, we're doing the same thing. We begin the Mass by dropping our mask and being honest with God. Like, I'm a sinner, right? Like, we can hide that from everybody else. But when it comes to God, we have to drop the mask. And that's what the liturgy in the first movement is telling us to do. Confess our sins. Be contrite. Be repentant. Mea culpa. Mea culpa. Mea culpa. All right. So Jeremiah says, I hear the whisperings. All my friends are waiting for me to stumble. I hear the whisperings. All my friends are waiting for me to stumble. In the same way, we've said that I've sinned through my fault. And so we share in that confession. So both of these are acts of like spiritual honesty. Jeremiah's confessions aren't self-loathing. They're relational. He brings his whole self into God's presence so he can stand in the truth. And so the penitential rite is the same thing, a communal version of that same move. Dropping the mask, bringing our whole self to God. And so this is why we begin by standing in truth so that God can act. And this is really a great prayer when we stand before God. And we could just tell God sometimes, like, God, you know everything that's going on in my life. Like, you know me. And you could be completely transparent from God, in front of God. And God wants that. He wants that transparency because he knows us. But sometimes, you know, God wants us to confess like who we are in front of him. Like, this is exactly who I am. So he can hear it, because when we confess to God who we are, it's our way of also relating with God. Like, God, I'm a sinner and you're holy. Okay. And so the second thing that Jeremiah does to move from fear to mission, that he entrusts to God in a way that we entrust to the crucified Jesus. So he entrusts God, himself to God. And Jeremiah refuses to take revenge or take control of the outcome. And that's a good lesson, especially in our relationships outside of the home, you know, in a workspace or someone else. You know, someone does something to us. Like, one thing that we always, you know, crosses our mind is, oh, man, I should get revenge, right? I should do to them what they did to me. How would they feel? And so with Jeremiah, he ends everything over. He says this. He says, to you, I have entrusted my cause. And in the same way, the Liturgy of the Catholic Mass takes that instinct and it anchors it in a cross. At the altar, the church doesn't entrust our cause to ourselves. It entrusts it to God. And we unite it to God in his suffering, in his sacrifice, in his self-offering. And so Jeremiah, you notice that he entrusts his life to God's justice. Like, he doesn't like his life. At one time, he complains about even being born, right? But he entrusted his life to his, you know, his father, into in the same way we in the same way that Jesus entrusts his life to his father's will when he's at Calvary. And so in the same way, we entrust our lives to the one crucified Jesus Christ, who has already carried the weight of Jeremiah, who's already carried our weight in the only name that can carry the weight of sin, Jesus Christ. And so the liturgy of the Eucharist, it becomes the place where Jeremiah's his cry finds fulfillment. Not just, Lord, take this, but Lord, take this into your sacrifice. So Jeremiah, he wishes that he could have lived in our time, right? That where Jesus Christ came and took away all everything that we can ever experience or feel. In the Mass, in the Sursum Corda prayer, we offer that. We say we lift up our hearts. We place our hearts with God. Like, so we unite all of our pain and all our suffering with the risen Lord and everything that he overcame. So that's where we place all of our sorrows, all of our worries, all of our anxieties, and all of our fears. And then the Mass comes in the Et Missa Est, in a dismissal, to convert all everything that we're feeling, all of our sins, everything we confess, all of our worries. Because we lifted all those up to God, because we nailed those to the cross of Jesus, now we're free for mission. And so Jeremiah's final move, his mission, even when he's afraid, right? When Jeremiah says, there is in my heart a burning fire, I cannot hold on to it. And so this is how the Mass ends, by igniting that same fire in the Et Missa Est. In the Et Missa Est, go, you're dismissed. It's not some sort of dismissal in a way that, oh, it's ended, the Mass is over. No, it's a clarion call. It's ascending. It's mission. This is why we came, to be forgiven of our sins, to receive the nourishment that we need, to receive the grace that we need, to receive the armor and the weapons that we need to go out and do battle in the world. So it's descending. And the church literally says that you have confessed like Jeremiah. You have entrusted like Jeremiah. Now go speak. Go evangelize. Go live. Go proclaim the truth like Jeremiah. So the prophet's loneliness and his lonely mission becomes the church's communal mission, that we're never alone in mission. Although it may feel like we're just alone and doing the right thing, when we're on mission, when we're doing the work of God, it's a communal mission. And it's a communal mission that stretches throughout eternity. Like, what we're doing, whatever you've been called to do in your vocation as father, as husband, as parent, as evangelizer, as whatever you're doing, whatever vocation that you have, you're not alone in that. That's because it belongs to God, has called you to do it. It's the church's communal mission. Everyone's with you throughout time and space. And so the weight that Jeremiah thought he had to carry alone, we carry all that together as Christians. So these are the things you want to remember. So those are the three takeaways. That number one, confess like Jeremiah, especially in a penitential rite. Stand before God or kneel before God and confess. Take off the mask and tell God who you are. And then entrust to God and to the crucified Jesus everything that's a burden to you, every fear, every worry. Just give it up. And you'll see, and you'll be surprised what's returned back to you. It's going to be like a peace that's beyond all understanding. And you know it's that peace comes from God, because you have no reason to feel peace. It'd be weird. Like, man, why do I feel peace right now? Like, because I have everything to worry about. Everything around me is collapsing. But I have peace in the middle of a fire. Not unless you know from, that that comes from God, but it only comes from God if you like nail everything to the cross. If you offer it all up, that's the only way to get that peace. If you're holding on to anything, you won't have any peace. So you got to give it all up. And then the third thing, now that you're free, you have to accept your mission because you're unburdened now. You don't have anything to worry about. So you just have to do whatever God has called you to do. So that's the S, I miss the S. So this is how to live the mass. If you want to know more about how to live the mass in your daily life, again, check out my book. It's the Liturgical Sense of the Read the Mass. You get a St. Dominic's Media. Make sure you live, use the code I love the mass. Or I also just have resources at St. Dominic's Media about how to live in the mass. Check out my Lenten retreat. It's a 4-day retreat. You can take it on your own pace and just record it. And I have, when you go to the course, you'll see a guide there. It's called a Liturgical Life Daily Exam. It's like the Nation Daily Exam, but it's better. And so it's a daily exam that you begin in the morning. You structure your morning like the mass, and then you go live it. And then at the end of the day, you come back and you take the exam. Like, okay, how did I live the sign of the cross? How did I live the liturgy of the word? So it follows the mass. And like, did you live your life liturgically? So take that, check that out. Awesome resources, and I appreciate you guys coming in. Oh, my friend Deacon. Oh my gosh, my friend Deacon Majors here. See, this is what happens when I start the live stream at 9 o'clock. The deacon who's in California, San Francisco, he comes on. So yeah, I appreciate it, Deacon. It's amazing commentary on Jeremiah. Every time I listen to you, I learn something because I'm right here in my ministry at times where everyone around you is just drinking, drunken, wealthy fool, and they believe in a prosperity gospel, Catholic gospel. That's crazy. Prosperity Catholic gospel. That's wild. And have left God in the second place over their money. Yeah. So thank you for sure thing. Thank you, Deacon, for coming in, my friend. I appreciate you. And and Deacon, he actually wrote the foreword to this book. And so it's a powerful foreword. I really appreciate you, Deacon, for doing that for your brother. All right, y'all. I'm out here. I'll be back on the Friday. And Friday's show will just be, I think we're doing all guests that day. I think we have like 3 guests. It's going to be like a guest after guest after guest. So it's going to be a really good show. A lot of people talking about some very interesting things. All right. This has been David L. Gray in the morning. But until then, until next time, blessings and peace to you and to yours.
Yeah, wait, I want to this.
Wake up, it's time to start your day. No better way than rolling with David L. Gray. Wake up, it's praise and morning prayer. Then news and reflections with David L. Gray.